and welcome to a new edition of Mercenary Musings Radio, a bi-weekly audio program featuring mining analyst and commodities expert, the mercenary geologist, Mickey Fulp. We are your most trusted source for in-depth analysis and commentary on commodities, mining, and the junior resource sector. Joining us on the line from Albuquerque, New Mexico, the mercenary geologist himself, Mickey Fulp. Mickey, how have you been?
I've been well, gearing up, sir, for postseason baseball with my Cardinals, as I'm sure with your Blue Jays.
Yes, indeed. The Blue Jays qualifying for post-regular season baseball for the first time in 22 years, so a lot of people up here pumped about that. Mickey, it should be a good time. I know that this is your favorite time of the year, also with the start of the NFL, isn't it?
Well, it is, but right now I'm really focused on baseball, and the Cardinals are in their fifth postseason in a row, so it's
kind of running
the usual expectation in St. Louis.
And for this show, Mickey, we're going to be digging into the development of the periodic table, a couple of giant names in this area. Where do you want to begin? Because there's a lot of information on the plate.
Yeah, well, there is. And so I got kind of inspired by a recent show on PBS in the States called The Mystery of Matter, Search for the Elements. And you know, I have a minor in chemistry, and I actually taught physical chemistry at a couple of graduate schools. So I was kind of enthralled by this. And they go through seven giants in chemistry and the discovery of the elements development periodic table.
Mm-hmm.
First one, and we're going to pick it up toward the end of this, but in the early 1900s, there was this guy named Harry Moseley, and he was a Brit, and the son and grandsons of famous scientists, but he really contributed at a young age to the development of what we know in the periodic table. And his discovery was that X-rays, if you ran them through a crystal, they would diffract, and each element had a unique spectrum, which eventually led to X-ray spectroscopy and X-ray diffraction. And for anybody that has a degree in chemistry or physics or even geology in college, you use an X-ray diffraction machine. Mm-hmm. But his real contribution was with his studies at a very young age. By the time he was 25, he had discovered that atomic number was the important organization of the periodic table, and not atomic weight. And at that time, people didn't even understand the nature of the atom. They didn't know protons existed. They suspected, but this clarified that. He developed something called Moseley's staircase, or Moseley's law, arranging the periodic table by atomic number. And he was able to predict there were seven missing elements, and he predicted that X-ray spectra would be unique, and all these would be discovered, which they were in the period from 1917 to about 1940. Meanwhile, he volunteered for World War I and died at Gallipoli at 27 years old. So an important guy in the development of the periodic table.
Yeah, so important, I believe, Mickey, that because of his death, there was a lot of lobbying of the British government to protect people like Moseley. And in fact, the British government then put a ban in place on other scientists of repute serving in frontline roles. So it was very unfortunate that he got shot and killed. But because of his death, others were protected going forward, which I'm sure turned out to be a very smart move.
Well, it certainly did, and that kind of segues into our next story, and that would be starting in 1939, right before the beginning of World War II, when Germany invaded Poland in 1939, if memory serves. There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle buried in the back pages about German chemists had split the uranium atom with neutrons.
Mm-hmm.
And this inspired a guy named Glenn Seaborg at UC Berkeley, which eventually became Lawrence Livermore Labs, one of the big national labs in the U.S. that still does lots of nuclear research. It inspired him to go in and try to create elements, and it also inspired another a bunch of other scientists who became fearful that the Germans would develop the atomic bomb before the U.S. could. Einstein wrote a letter to Roosevelt, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I believe Seaborg was actually getting his hair cut when he read this article, wasn't
well,
he?
One of I think the story actually is one of his associates was getting his hair cut.
Okay, right.
But he became inspired. And these guys essentially ended up doing what, led by Seaborg, they did what the alchemists had been trying to do for 1,000 years or longer, and that was create new elements out of other elements, or create various elements from doing chemical and physical experiments on them. So anyway, so there was this thing at Lawrence Livermore Labs called the cyclotron. It didn't take Seaborg very long before he had synthesized neptunium, which we've talked about before. That's 93 on the periodic table. But most importantly, plutonium, which ended up being fissile and ended up being developed into the majority of atomic bombs. Because at the time, Seaborg synthesized plutonium, there were only very, very small quantities of fissile uranium, 0.7% uranium-235. So they could not develop uranium bombs quickly and in sufficient quantities if there was a nuclear atomic war. So his work developed plutonium in 1940. It was kept secret until after the end of the war. By 1941, they had shown it was fissile, and at that time, Fermi was at the University of Chicago. The first nuclear reactor was built, I had no idea about this, was built out of wood, graphite, and uranium, if you can imagine.
that was in Chicago, wasn't it?
A wooden nuclear reactor. Fermi developed a chain reaction in 1942 with uranium, shown it was feasible. By 1943, because plutonium is so radioactive and so toxic, they built a remote control separation plant in Hanford, Washington, which Seaborg ran. And 2 years later, in my home state of New Mexico, the Trinity bomb was set off on July 6th in 1945. Mm-hmm. And by August 6th, a month later, we had used a plutonium bomb called Fat Man on Hiroshima. And on August 9th, we used our one and only uranium bomb called Little Boy on Nagasaki, which ended the war.
Right. And Seaborg went on to win a Nobel Prize in 1951, I believe, in chemistry. And he was the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission from 61 to 71.
Well, that's true, and post-war he continued to synthesize elements, or even during the war he synthesized americium, which we've talked about, which is used in smoke detectors. He synthesized curium, number 96. In 49 and 50 he synthesized berkelium and californium. And although those elements were synthesized, they were later found to occur in very small quantities in nature.
And how many synthetic elements are there right now?
Well, now, so the synthetic elements, so we've gone through number 98, which is californium. We talked about that when we talked about the actinides during the summer. We're now up to 20 synthetic elements that don't occur in nature, only occur through manufacture and directed experiments for the most part to create them in nuclear reactors. Some of them were found in atomic bomb, hydrogen bomb blasts, or particle accelerators. They have very short half-lives from microseconds to days. So we're now up to 118 is the number. So we've created, what?
Jeez, we were at 21. 90, right. Some of them
20,
don't.
21 20 elements, yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
Some of them don't even have a name.
Well, that's true. Four of them are not yet named. Most of them have been named by after Nobel Prize winners in either chemistry or physics, some of the giants in atomic science, or in the labs or the cities in which they were first created.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But the ones that, there are four of them that still don't have names, and they are named such things as un-un-tritium, to un-un-octium. Well, these are Latin words. Un-un, the Latin word for one is un, and mm-hmm. so tritium is three, and octium is eight. So yeah. 113, 115, 117, and 118 don't even have names yet. And the discovery of some of these is, you know, they'll, three or four atoms would qualify as a discovery to maybe 100 atoms. Some of them, less than 100 atoms have ever been created.
Yeah, and some of them named after, well, some of the people we just talked about. There's Seaborgium, I believe.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So he was one of two scientists ever to have an element named after him while he was still living.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is Einstein. And if memory serves, Einsteinium is...
That's correct.
Number
99,
I think.
99.
So Seaborgium is number 106.
And you know, Mickey, I just watched the one segment of that three-part PBS series. I encourage anybody, even if you don't understand half of the stuff that they're talking about, it's a fascinating series. It's well done, isn't it?
Oh, I thought so, you know, and it's hard for me sometimes to figure out how much this is readily accessible to the layman because, you know, I am a trained geologist with lots of hours of chemistry and physics in college. But, yeah, I found this fascinating. If you like science documentaries,
mm-hmm.
I think you will very much appreciate this one. And let's go back and end this with talking about Moseley. You know, we always like to end these things with some practicality, and these synthesized elements are not, that's just pure science research and not really practical.
Mm-hmm.
But of the seven elements that Moseley predicted would exist based and would be identified based on their X-ray spectra when they were once found, three of those seven have significant uses. Technetium 43, technetium 99 is used in dozens and dozens of diagnostical medical tests.
Mm-hmm.
It's so rare it's made in nuclear reactors. And then there's hafnium, number 72, which mm-hmm. is a critical component in nuclear fuel rods because it's a neutron interceptor, and it is a product of the extraction of zirconium ores, occurs in minute quantities and is separated. And then finally there's rhenium, which we talked about, and it's right below molybdenum in the periodic table. It is separated from moly ores, and it is a critical component in super alloys used in jet engines. And also, every time you fill up your car, the only reason you have lead-free gasoline, high-octane gasoline now, is because it's used with platinum as a catalyst to crack petroleum.
Okay, well, great stuff. And again, yeah, I'm going to watch the rest of that series. Like I said, you don't have to be a scientist or a chemist to certainly appreciate and watch in awe at some of the work that these people did so long ago, and just amazing stuff. Let's wrap it up there. Mickey, what do you want to do next time out?
Well, we will continue. We're still trying to work our way through the periodic table. I think we've got the unobtainiums of the world talked about now, and that mm-hmm. would be the synthetic elements. Next time we're going to go into the noble gases, and we've already talked about helium, but we've got a bunch of more to talk about. And it's when you get in that limo at Las Vegas Airport and go down on the strip, it wouldn't be lit up the way it is if it wasn't for neon lights and those noble gases.
Okay, great stuff. And they keep adding new elements too. Mickey, this could be our never-ending search, you know?
I don't think we're going to find very many more elements in the near term. There's unfortunately, they don't really have any use so far.
Right. Okay, good stuff. Thanks a lot, Mickey, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
All right, thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Mickey Fulp, the Mercenary Geologist. You can find him on the web at mercenarygeologist.com. And you can always hear Mickey's latest opinion exclusively on mercenarygeologist.fm and kitco.com. I'm Robert Graham at Mercenary Musings Radio. Thanks for listening.